I'm super actually excited to have Terry Gunlock teaching this morning. You might be going, Terry, oh yeah, we haven't had Terry. She was laughing because the way the schedule turned out is she's right here at the tail end. We're going to get her twice here at the tail end, but we haven't had her yet. So I'm super excited. I love Terry. I love how she shares of herself. And so I'm super grateful to have Terry. I'm going to read our passage this morning, and then Terry's going to come up and share. If you want to turn to page 100, that's where we'll be. It's Matthew 5, 38 through 42. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Here's Terry.
Good morning. It's nice to be back with you. I didn't know the song that Christina played, but I love the part that says, so much better your way. Your great defender, so much better your way. And my title for today is A Better Way. So it's nice that it tied in, and I didn't even know. thank you for sharing with us this morning. That was quite a story. It's always hard to go after that. Sweet baby. And it kind of fits in with fairness. But I wanted to ask this morning, when kids get about two, when they can talk, besides saying no, what is one of the first things they say? Mine, okay, that's a good one. Anyone else think of something else? Mom, yeah. Well, I don't remember back to my boys, but my grandkids, one of the favorite things they say is, it's not fair. You ever hear them say that? Do we ever say that? I had my grandkids, three of the oldest ones, for a weekend a couple weeks ago, and they're to the point where if they get a special treat or cereal, if one of them gets 1/2 inch higher than the other one, it's not fair. You got more than I got. And one was not going to eat her candy that night, but she was afraid if she saved it for the next day, then they had already eaten theirs, they would get actually more. So I said, well, then just eat it. But life is not fair, but not only little kids, but we as adults want it to be fair, don't we? And it's not. It's not fair that this little baby had to be born like that. That's not fair that in the way that we think, but God uses it. Some things are grossly unfair in our world and in our lives. And just, I was thinking of the shootings. It's not fair that those particular people got killed. And there's so many things like that that are tragic. There's a story that many of us have heard over the years where a man killed someone's daughter, and of course he was put in jail, and eventually the mother of the girl went and forgave him in jail. And that, I just saw that story on the internet again, and it's just so amazing. Those are stories that a lot of times we don't face those, and I couldn't give every idea this morning, so I'm going to center more on just the more simple things that we face every day, but I don't want to undermine the gross, hard, horrible things that happen. So I just wanted to give that little whatever clarity. So I had three events happen to me within the last month or so that were interesting. My car got hit by a big white truck and it was declared total. Then my husband got his wallet stolen in St. Petersburg when we were on a mission trip to Russia. And then a week after we returned, I was biking, which I've done for 33 years, and for the first time a guy in a big white truck opened his door on me. So I'm a little scared of big white trucks. Both my car getting hit and me on a bike were just accidents, but I had to bear the consequences. I had to have all the hassle of trying to get my car fixed, and even though they said it was totaled, I got it fixed, and it's great. I could have gotten really hurt on the bike, and I didn't. I crashed hard, but I believe that God graciously let me down. I hit my elbow, you know, on my side, and I still have a little scab here that reminds me when I feel it, but I did not get hurt. Both of the men that hit my car and me were in these big white trucks in construction, and I wanted to say I couldn't have had two nicer men hit me than my car. They felt horrible. The one that hit my car, God said, are you okay? Are you okay? And he got his insurance right out, and I'll do anything. And the one on the bike, as I was kind of lying there in the road, he just came out. I'm so sorry I didn't see you. Here, let me help you. And he got a Band-Aid for my elbow, and he gave me his card and said, you know, if you have to go to the hospital or if you have to get your bike fixed, just call me. I'll pay. And I, by the time they were so nice, I was feeling sorry for them. I actually hugged one of them. I said, it's okay. I'm okay. There was no retaliation, you know, on either side. There was no blaming, no yelling, because, I mean, I was ready for one of them to say, didn't you see me? You know, and there wasn't any of that. So sometimes things can be handled nicely when both parties don't want to retaliate. My husband getting his wallet stolen was another story. We were in a crowded subway in St. Petersburg, Russia. And I guess it's a bad place for pickpockets, but we were a little naive. And unfortunately, my husband had his wallet in his back pocket, and it was visible. So we've learned a big lesson. But there's a kind of a ring of Russian guys, I think, that look for that and probably tell someone, get on this part of the trams or the subway. So the door opens. These guys get in. It was a really crowded time. They picked that. And they were kind of jostling him, and some were kind of hitting him in the front. So got his attention away, and the guy took it out of his back pocket. And Terry felt it leave, and so he screamed, thief, and he started to trace after him. But then they got out because the subway doors don't stay open long, and we actually held them open and ran out. And one of the guys we were with tried to grab someone, but they were gone. And, we learned. But my husband was not real happy. He was angry. He felt violated, and he wanted to have retaliation for sure. And he and the other guy, they were funny, but they were talking all the way back to our hotel. Now, this is what we should have done, and I'm going to invent this thing, a taser that you put on a wallet and leave it kind of exposed. So if someone steals my wallet, they're going to get shocked. He felt not just violated, but he felt the worst of all, incompetent, the hidden stupid, that he shouldn't let that happen. And I think he was more upset that the guy got away with it and he didn't catch him than actually losing what he lost. But I think when something like that happens, it's natural to want revenge, isn't it? And I thought, is this what Jesus is talking about in this section? If we could have, should we have said, oh, not just my wallet, but here, take my wife's purse too. I don't think that's what Jesus means in this. Pickpocketing is against the law, even in Russia, and it would have to be taken care of by the law. So what on earth is this passage saying? I don't know if you guys had trouble, but when I looked at it, I thought, oh my goodness, how am I going to do this? As I studied, I learned that this particular section of Scripture has been more misunderstood and misapplied and misused on almost any. It's been used to justify abuse and violence, pacifism, and other things. And I'm supposed to make it make sense. When we as speakers look at these passages and they're only five verses, you think, what on earth are we going to speak on for half an hour? And by the time we get down studying, we're thinking, how on earth are we going to cut it down to half an hour? So you can only say so much in 30 minutes, but here I go. I did get help, which was so great, from commentaries that we usually look at. There was something on the internet my husband found that was really helpful. But a wonderful thing that happened is Terry Lawson, who's in this Bible study, was back in Tennessee visiting her daughter and went to her church. And the pastor happened to be preaching on this exact sermon. And then Terry told me, and I listened. He was fabulous, and he was so good. I just wanted to play it this morning for you. But I thought, that's not right. I have to make it mine. And so I have. However, I'm going to use some illustrations from him, and I want to make sure I give them credit. His name is Darren Whitehead, and he's from Church of the City in Franklin, Tennessee. He's really a good speaker. I told my son he might be getting some competition here. But what I learned from all of the reading I did is that the context is so important. What does the Bible really mean when it says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? This comes from the Old Testament. It's found in Exodus, and it's sometimes called Lex Talionis, which means the law of retaliation. And it's actually part of the Mosaic law that's used in the Israelites' justice system. The main principle is that the punishment must fit the crime, and there should be a just penalty for evil actions. is actually, and I think you probably heard this, more of a preventive law that says you can't do more than that was done to you. So if your neighbor stole something from you, you don't go and burn his house down. It should be the punishment should fit the crime. And I thought this was interesting. There's actually no account in the Old Testament of the Bible of someone actually getting their eye gouged out, and then they go and gouge someone else's eye out. It's more of a, Jesus talks in big pictures sometimes to get our attention. It's just a principle. And usually in this case, in the Old Testament, it was the punishment was in the form of money. Not always. If someone died, then there was capital punishment. But if someone hurt someone's hand, they would have to pay them money to make up for the work that they would lose. So often it was a lot of time monetary repayment. I think the movie Les Mis, we hate the part, don't we, when Jean Valjean steals a piece of bread to feed his sister's children, and he's stuck in prison until he actually escapes. That is not an eye for an eye at all. So not fair. The main point is that the eye for an eye is mentioned 3 times in the Old Testament, and each time, this is interesting, the phrase is used in the context of a case being a judge before a civil authority, such as a judge. It was only intended to be a guiding principle for lawgivers and judges. But as Sherry shared last week, something that was so interesting to me, that the Pharisees made up their own traditions. And that's not what Jesus is talking about. That's why he doesn't say, it is written. He says, I have heard that it was said. And that's what he's arguing against, not Old Testament law, but what the Pharisees have made up. And the Pharisees in this case had taken the eye for an eye principle and applied it to everyday relationships. They taught that seeking personal revenge was acceptable. If someone punches you, you punch them back. If someone insults you, you insult them back. In other words, do unto others as they do unto you. So on the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus counters the common teaching of personal retaliation by saying, You have heard it said, eye for an eye, but I tell you. And then he goes on to tell us. He reveals God's heart concerning personal relationships, and he uses 3 illustrations. Turn the other cheek, give your cloak as well as your tunic, go the extra mile. It's a radically, again, different teaching than for the Jews. And if they would follow it, it would turn their world upside down, just like it would ours, just like the Sermon on Mount is doing, turning our world upside down. In 1915, there was a man named Walter Cannon who came up with this theory of acute stress response. And he said that when we come across something like that, we either fight or flight. I'm sure we've all heard that, fight or flight. And Jesus is going to offer us a better way than to do either of those. Who's the Jews' enemy right now at this point that Jesus is talking in the Sermon on the Mount? Who's their main enemy? Romans, right. And they had hoped that the Messiah would come and as a strong military leader and defeat the Romans. And here, instead of that, Jesus is telling them to love their enemies. And they were probably their worst enemy at that time. Dave taught this Sunday, if you were there, on kind of a radical description of who our neighbor is. It kind of went along with this. But the first one example that Jesus uses is if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. He's very specific, isn't he? Why the right cheek? And I've asked Judy Brixey to come up here, and I'm copying the pastor. He gave this illustration, and I thought it was really helpful. So, Judy, come right over here. Okay. Why did Jesus say, turn, the right cheek? I don't know if you know, many of you do, but in that day, the left hand was used for something because they didn't have toilet paper and Charmin in those days, right? So in public, the left hand was never used to do things. And so the right hand is, and so if you would take your right hand to a right cheek, what would it be? It's a back slap. It's not a punch or an open hand, but it's more of a shaming thing. It's not like beating them up. It's a shameful thing, and they were in a shame-based culture, and so it was a great insult. And again, what would we normally do? We would fight them or run away.
Slap her back.
And Jesus had a better way, and he said, turn the other cheek. Okay, now with the right hand, it doesn't work to do it to the left cheek. And you're not allowed to just punch someone according to the law. So what does it do? It diffuses the whole thing, and it takes the power away from the oppressor and gives a peaceful power to the oppressed. Thank you, Judy. Isn't that interesting? I just thought that was a great example, and it's a quiet way to stand up for yourself with dignity in the face of an oppressor. And so that, at least, illustration helped me understand maybe that hitting the right side of the cheek. I want to just read. I would like to have had this on the PowerPoint. It's long, and Anne helps me, and the computer had Satan in it yesterday. Took us for half an hour to figure out how to do the black background instead of it's not even black. Anyway, so if you just listen carefully, there's a theologian named David Gersick, and he's kind of summing up what I've just been trying to say, and I think he says it well. It's wrong to think that Jesus means a physical attack cannot be resisted or defended against. I think this is really important. When Jesus speaks of a slap on your right cheek, it was culturally understood as a deep insult, not a physical attack. Jesus does not mean that if someone hits you across the right side of your head with a baseball bat, you should allow them to hit the left side. If a right-handed person strikes someone's right cheek, presumably it is a slap by the back of the hand, probably considered more insulting than a slap by the open palm. I thought that's interesting. And you know, sometimes we can just go, it's sort of insulting. It is also wrong to think Jesus means that there's no place for punishment or retribution in society. Jesus here speaks of personal relationships and not to the proper functions of government in restraining evil. In Romans, it tells us that they do. I must turn my cheek when I am personally insulted, but the government has a responsibility to restrain the evil man from physical assault. I just thought that was helpful. So they're two different things. Okay, the second illustration is if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. What does that mean? The word sue here is used, so it involves really going to court. The shirt is the undergarment, probably of a poor person, a person not in power, the vulnerable person, going after them when they might not have anything more than their shirt and coat. Again, that's shaming. So instead of fighting them when they want to take it or take you to court, you hand them their coat as well. And actually, it was against the law to take someone's coat in that day. As you can imagine, if you actually went to court, and I think this is, again, it was a hyperbole. Jesus gives these funny examples. And you had given them your shirt, and then you gave them their coat. What would you be left with? Nothing, or your underwear. And wouldn't that be shaming to be standing there? And I think, again, it takes the power away from the oppressor. It's doing the unexpected thing. And maybe the guy's standing there in his loincloth. And I was trying to look up PowerPoint pictures, and I made a big mistake. So we won't show any of the ones I saw, and I got out of there really fast. But I had this more biblical model of a loincloth, and it was not that at all. But when it gets to that ridiculous point, the oppressor might just think, I shouldn't have done this. What have I done to this poor person? And Jesus cares about us as people. So again, it's a very surprising response more than anything else. It changes often the heart of the oppressor. Okay, our third illustration is if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. And probably we get from this going the extra mile that we say so often. It's in a very interesting context also. Again, who had the power to force the Jews to go the extra mile? It was the Romans. And according to the Roman law, they had the right to force someone to walk 1 mile with them and carry their pack, which weighed about 85 pounds. But the law is clear also that they were only to do it for 1 mile. And the Romans were so organized in that day that there were mile markers along the road, so you could tell when it was time. And so you could stop then. And it was actually illegal for the Romans to force anyone to go more than 1 mile. And so Jesus is saying something different, because you could be carrying it and complaining and griping, but maybe do it cheerfully and then just keep walking past the mile mark. And the pastor that I listened to humorously said it'd be kind of funny, because as he kept going nicely, the Romans might start saying, you don't have to go any further. They'll stop. Put down my pack. And that's, again, a surprising response. So in all three examples, Jesus is teaching the oppressed how to take power away from the oppressor in an unexpected move of peaceful defiance that actually restores dignity to the oppressed. I love that. Jesus cares about human dignity for each of us, and this is a good way to show it. In the last section of our passage, it says, give to the one who asks you, and don't turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. We don't fight them. We don't flee. Instead, we show them a better way. Radical new way for me, for sure, and for the Jews. Jesus embodied the better way, and we have such a beautiful picture of him in Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 8. Many of you know this. I'm just going to read it. It says, in your relationships, one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used for his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the form of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. That passage always gets me. Jesus gave up his rights and humbled himself. And on the Sermon on the Mount that we've been hearing, that's the attitude that we're looking for in the Beatitudes, about being meek and merciful and poor in spirit. Without that, we could never do some of these things that Jesus is telling us to do in this passage. Even with him, it's almost impossible sometimes. So my question today is, how practically do we apply this? We probably won't get hit on the cheek, but you never know. We probably won't have our undergarments stolen from us or asked to carry a pack, although all of those things happen in other countries where Christians are persecuted more. But how about here in Orange County? How do we apply the better way? And these are just going to be everyday examples, not the tragic ones that are so hard. In our lesson, we were asked, what do you find most difficult about turning the other cheek? What are the risks of doing that? When have you turned the other cheek, and what did it require? I hope that you had time to think about those. Oops. When someone belittles you, how do you respond? When someone talks about you poorly to others and you hear about that, or lies about you, what do you do? When you ask someone forgiveness and you really mean it and they won't accept it or forgive you, how do you respond? When someone talks badly about your spouse or your children, or heaven forbid, your grandchildren, what do we do? When we're accused falsely, that really hurts, doesn't it? What do we do with that? When your motives are made to be bad, when you meant good, you never had that intention, when you're totally misunderstood, when a friend has something against you and you know it, but maybe they won't tell you, what do you do? When your husband has hurt you, things with children, what is God calling us to do? What is your tendency? Is it to fight back, or is it to have flight and move away and just get away from it? How many are fighters in here? Fighters. How many would be more the ones that would go on flight? Yeah, fly away. But neither one are the way that Jesus is saying. It would be easy as a retaliator to say, if someone says something bad about me, well, I'm just going to say something bad about them. And if I heard them gossiping about me, that's issue women have, I'm going to gossip back. If they won't forgive me, this, instead of retaliating, is just, I'm done with them. I'm just walking away. I'm not going to keep trying. When I'm hurt, it's so easy to want to hurt back. But does it really make us feel good? It doesn't. Not in the long run. What's the risk of doing this the better way? And I was thinking, you do the right thing back, and it's not accepted. That's really hard. That's a risk. And then when you keep trying, it hurts more, I think, than just not trying at all. And that can produce in our lives anger, bitterness, hurt. And then that sort of starts building, and we want to hang on to that anger and hurt. And that leads to a bitterness which can start to poison everything. And that's why Jesus tells us to turn the other cheek. He is keeping us from allowing bitterness to poison us and the others around us. And there was a verse in Hebrews that I read so many years ago, and I remember exactly where it was, and it had to be 25 years ago. Hebrews 12:15, that says, "See to it that no one falls short of the grace of God, and that no bitter root grows up, causing trouble to defile many." And God showed me that if I had bitterness or that resentment in my heart, it wasn't just affecting me. It went out and spread out, and that's what can happen. And I've just seen that happen this year, and it's so hard to see. But it's hard to turn the other cheek when the other person's done something, and we can cry out like my grandkids, "It's not fair." But fairness is not promised to us, but what's promised is if we follow God's way of forgiveness, and it leads to freedom. And I love the article in our book that Christina put in our book by John Piper, and it's on page 105. And I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs because it says it better than I can. So when we have this bitterness, this desire to retaliate maybe, it says, laying down the burden of retaliation, laying down the practice of nursing your hurt with feelings of being wronged, laying that down does not mean there was no great wrong against you. I think this is so important. I think if we think we lay it down, then they're going to get away with it. There was great wrong done to you, but it also does not mean there's no justice. It does not mean you will not be vindicated. It does not mean they just got away with it. They didn't. It means when you lay down the burden of vengeance, God will pick it up. And that's not a subtle way of getting revenge. That was funny. This is a way of giving vengeance to the one to whom it belongs. "Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. You lay it down, I will pick it up. Justice will be done." And what a glorious relief that is, isn't it? And this last past year, I was working so hard to solve a problem in a group and between other people, and it just became kind of my focus. And I heard God say to me one morning in a quiet time, "Lay it down. Give it to me. You're almost making an idol out of this." And I thought it was a good thing I was doing. I wasn't retaliating. I was just trying to work something out, but I wasn't giving it to God. And I was almost, he said to me almost, "You're losing your first love. So give it to me." So I love this. What a glorious relief. We do not have to carry this burden. It is like taking a deep breath, perhaps for the first time in decades, and feeling that now at last we may be made free to love. Isn't that beautiful? Okay. Now I lost my place. I'm sorry. I'm over here. There's a picture of friends that have laid it down. Isn't that beautiful? I'm really working on that. The older I get, the more important I see it is. And you think when you grow up, you won't have those problems, but sometimes they can get worse. So carrying resentments and hurts makes me more miserable, and I love when I can give them over to God. But it's so easy to give them and then take them back, isn't it? I would like to learn how to do the unexpected, as Jesus has told us, and follow a better way that is contrary to my natural tendencies. And I think another verse that fits with this whole topic is in Proverbs, "A soft answer turns away wrath." Haven't you had experiences like that? I was driving my car again, and I did something kind of silly, and this man got so angry at me, and he was yelling, and I just rolled down my window, and I went, "I'm so, so sorry. I just didn't see you. That was really dumb of me," or something, and his attitude just changed, so that was neat. And there's another verse that talks about God calls us to forgive people, but then in this passage it said, but then give them a blessing, a second thing. And there was a guy friend, and he had really hurt us and done some things that weren't very nice, and I read that verse, and God said, do that to him, forgive him, but then go give him a blessing. And it was like, I can forgive, but do I have to do the blessing? Go the extra mile. And God said yes, and I did. And it didn't solve everything, but it sure took away the bitterness and anger, and it was the start to building back a relationship. So I wanted to close this morning by showing a video of a man named Julio Diaz, who I think really exemplifies doing things a better way. And I wish I could do something like this. It's a little unusual, but I think it's a good example that we can visually see, hopefully. 1 minute. He did something so unexpected that it changed the heart of his oppressor. And they became friends. Ready? 5 minutes? Oh, there it is. Okay. It worked this morning. Talk amongst yourselves. No. Okay, all you computer people, which
so
I'm not.
So I get off the train. Oh, and I'm walking towards the stairs, and this young teenager pulls out a knife. He wants my money, so I just gave him my wallet, told him, here you go. He starts to leave, and as he's walking away, I'm like, hey, wait a minute, you forgot something. If you're going to be robbing people for the rest of the night, you might as well take my coat to keep you warm. So, you know, he's looking at me like, what's going on here, you know? And he asks me, well, why are you doing this? And I'm like, well, I don't know, man. If you're willing to risk your freedom for a few dollars, then I guess you must really need the money. I mean, all I wanted to do was go get dinner. And if you really want to join me, hey, you're more than welcome. So I'm like, look, you can follow me if you want. You know, I just felt maybe he really needs help. So, you know, we go into the diner where I normally eat. We sit down in the booth, and the manager comes by, the dishwashers come by, the waiters come by to say hi, you know. So the kid was like, man, but you know everybody here. Do you own this place? I'm like, no, I just eat here a lot. He's like, but you're even nice to the dishwasher. I'm like, well, haven't you been taught you should be nice to everybody? So he's like, yeah, but I didn't think people actually behave that way. So I just asked him in the end, I'm like, you know, what is it that you want out of life? He just had almost a sad face. Either he couldn't answer me or he didn't want to. The bill came, and I look at him and I'm like, look, I guess you're going to have to pay for this bill because you have my money and I can't pay for this. So if you give me my wallet back, I'll gladly treat you. He didn't even think about it. He's like, yeah, okay, here you go. So I got my wallet back and I gave him $20 for, you know, I figure maybe it'll help him. I don't know. And when I gave him the $20, I asked him to give me something in return, which was his knife. And he gave it to me. You know, it's funny because when I told my mom about what happened, you know, no mom wants to hear this, but with her, she was like, well, you know, you're the type of kid that always someone asked you for the time, you gave them your watch. I don't know, I figure, you know, you treat people right, you can only hope that they treat you right. It's as simple as it gets in this complicated world.
It is on. Okay. Oops. Early on. We talked about being salt and light earlier on in the Sermon on the Mount. That is certainly salt and light, isn't it? Doing the unexpected, not fighting, not fleeing away, but doing the better way, the way that Jesus says. And I love his example. I would love to be that cool to be able to do something in that situation. Another verse in Matthew says, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. If we do things a better way, the world will say, this is remarkable. It will make Christianity look beautiful. So let's just pray and ask God for that.